Welcome to The Art Show. My name is John Connell. My co-presenter is Karen Meenan. And this evening we're featuring two local writers. Clontarf-based Vanessa Pierce has just had her first novel recently published by Vulpine Press. And the name of the novel is Deniable Memories. It's a nerve-wracking tale of a volunteer aid worker in Khartoum, Sudan, in 1989. But first, Karen Meenan interviews Vanessa Pierce, begins by asking Vanessa about the title of her book.
Vanessa, first of all, tell us about your book, the title, Deniable Memories. Very intriguing.
Well, I suppose I'm always fascinated by memory. Mm-hmm. And it's always struck me that no matter how many people are at something, they all have different memories, and particularly when it comes to family. And families, if something doesn't suit them, they'll... We all do it in everything. We write our own version of what happens, I think, to suit ourselves.
But I think there's truth in there as well, Vanessa, because we can all be at the same thing at the same time and have a completely different memory of the event, can't we?
Oh, absolutely. And it's determined by our own experiences and what's happening for us in our emotional lives.
And age as well has a lot to do with it. You know, if you're a younger person experiencing that and you don't have the adult lens, when you're looking back on something, it's very hard to remember back what happened when you say if the event happened as a child.
Oh, absolutely. But I think also that we do, if you like, filter it sometimes.
Yes, yeah.
Subconsciously to suit what we want to think of ourselves, even to feel safe sometimes if things are happening if bad things happen to us, sometimes we filter them out for our own self-preservation.
Yeah, that's all about safety. So, Vanessa, first of all, before we dive into the book, would you mind reading us a little paragraph from it so we can get some sense of place and tell us, if you read us a little chapter or a piece of a chapter, and then we can talk about the setting of the book and why you wrote it.
Certainly. Now, you can stop me if I'm going on too long. I'll just try and give you a sense of it. This is from the first chapter. I'll read you a couple of extracts. On the flight to Khartoum, the voice in Martha's head grew louder and louder. By the time the plane had landed, it was screaming. Martha, what effing planet were you on when you thought Sudan was a good idea? She threw her backpack over her shoulder and nervously felt for two money belts worn under her heavy top. The top was another bad choice, ideal for the Irish winter, not the Saharan heat. Its only consolation was that it served well to hide the dreaded money belts. The belt to the front contained her own $300 cash. The one to the back contained $10,000 that the charity's head office had handed to her with the abrupt instruction, "Do not declare this at the airport." Her silent response apparently implied willing consent. She followed the other passengers into the bustling building, rating her body a 2 or 3 on the Richter scale, a noticeable tremor. How the hell did other people walk into busy airports or other public places carrying drugs or weapons without their nerves alone giving them away? Salaam alaikum, the man at the first desk barked at her, taking her out of her internal, rapidly unsettling ramblings. She shuddered and stared open-mouthed at his dark face, his military khakis, and his old but threatening machine gun. He put a form into her hand, and she squinted at its indecipherable Arabic. She looked up at him, pleading for help. He turned it over and pointed to the top of the page, where it read, "Foreign Currency Declaration Form," in plain English. She took the pen he offered and declared $300 for personal use. She rummaged in her brain for reassurance that she was doing the right thing. Was she about to smuggle? Yes, smuggle $10,000 through an airport teeming with security. They hadn't told her about all the security. And then I'll just skip on a bit. She'd packed for the year that she planned to be away, and that included 1 year's supply of tampons, which to save space she'd taken out of their packaging. As she remembered this, to her horror, the man took one tampon out of her case, then another, until he had about 20 of them set neatly on the table. He turned and addressed Martha. I don't speak Arabic, she mumbled. The officer pointed at the tampons. Martha inhaled his stale cigarette breath as he brought his face close to hers. She met his gaze, coughed, and backed away. She looked from his dark eyes to his finger pointed at the tampons. He was asking her to explain them. He seemed willing to wait, however long it took. She stared back at him, her mind whirling in mortification and fear. How do you explain tampons without words? She cursed the absence of the little leaflets that would have explained everything with their simple pictures. The officer then picked up one tampon and proceeded to sniff it from end to end like a large cigar. Martha envisaged him smoking it and was scared that he would try. Thankfully, he stopped short of putting it in his mouth and lighting it. When he seemed to have grown bored with the game, if it was a game, he smiled at her and indicated for her to move on. He stamped her currency form and handed it back. He lifted her case off the table, sending 10 or more tampons rolling to the floor. She considered leaving them there, but thought the better of it and bent down to pick them up. "Thanks," she said sheepishly, as a jelly-bearded man retrieved one from under the table and handed it to her. He smiled at her and she averted her eyes, peering deliberately down at the ground in search of more. He took her lead and retrieved another one from under the next table. "Shukran," Martha mumbled uncertainly, keeping her head down, surprised that her brain, in its muddle of terror, found one of the Arabic words that she had read. She repacked the tampons and her other items into her now chaotic suitcase. She felt the sweat run down her back as she struggled to slip it closed. In the end, she took some of the clothes and shoved them into her backpack. The quicker she could get out, the better.
Wow. So that creates the tension, Vanessa. Now,
well,
I've read your book and I really enjoyed it. And what I liked about it very much was it gave a window into the whole world of South Sudan. And I've never been an NGO, but I've had friends who've gone to work and live in Africa over the years. So just for our listeners, please let us know how much of this, I know it's a work of fiction, but how much of it is autobiographical or semi-autobiographical? Like, you actually went to Sudan.
I did. At the end of 89, I went to Sudan. Mm. And it was a complete eye-opener for me.
Okay.
We didn't have Google then, so I didn't have, you know, the wherewithal to go looking up and finding. There wasn't. I actually went at very short notice.
And why?
So I didn't.
Like, why was that? I know Martha's idea, when people ask her that question in the book, this is the main character in the book, she says, "I've had a good life and I want to give something back." So I'm just curious about Vanessa Pierce. What was your inspiration to go to Sudan at very short notice?
Well, I had had a taste of spending a few weeks in Zimbabwe and was kind of very taken about the whole African experience. But on top of that, I did actually feel, I personally, well, in this book, Martha, it isn't Martha's thing. In reality, I did feel that I had had a good life and that I could give something back. Mm. And I suppose, to be perfectly honest with you, based on my experience, I kind of felt we were going in there as thinking we knew it all as white people, and that really we had an awful lot to learn. We, you know, this whole white superiority that we knew better, and we felt that capitalism was the way forward and everybody should be pushing to create more and spend more and all the rest. So it was a huge eye-opener for me, and I didn't realize I was an idealist before I went, but I suppose I came to realize it, you know. So that was really where I was coming from.
So a couple of the things that struck me as I was reading the book was there was a lot of corruption there. I mean, you hinted at it there that she was carrying the money belt with $10,000 and not to declare it. And that was literally from chapter one. So there were a few other instances in the book. And I'm not sure how many of those were real or imagined, but it did create tension.
Well, yes, for the most part, they're real. I mean, smuggling $10,000 in, I did have to do that, and I did find it absolutely terrifying.
It sounds it, yeah.
And so things related to the whole foreign exchange was very real. And there were people I talked to over there who were much more worldly wise than me and also worked for some of the big organizations, you know, like USAID or the UN. And they were very much of the opinion that the government enforced exchange rate, which was 4.5 Sudanese pounds to the dollar, which was totally a fixed rate, it bore no resemblance to reality, that the real rate was probably more like 60 or 70 Sudanese pounds to the dollar, and that therefore the fixed exchange rate being enforced was allowing them to finance the war.
Yeah,
and
you
therefore,
see, this is the thing
creating
that
creating the need.
Well, this is the thing that, that struck me as I was reading the book. It, on one level, it's a story about a girl called Martha who goes to Sudan and spends a year there. So on one sense, it's a very simple story. But on another level, there's huge hints at corruption, about, you know, wasteful resources, wasteful money, about there was another character, a car mechanic who was brought in all the way from Ireland with his partner to go and fix cars. And you're thinking, why weren't those jobs done by local people? And I know Martha hints at it all the time. Why are we doing these jobs, nursing jobs, admin jobs? And the other thing as well, there was Ethiopians working in the office and not Sudanese. So, you know, how much of that was real and how much of that was fiction?
You see, all of those things, while Martha's story is very much fictional, and it's the whole, if you like, a coming of age or whatever, coming to terms with her past, the actual background, an awful lot of that was very, very real. Mm. And it made me very uncomfortable. Now, I do believe that the aid industry has moved on a lot.
Well, that was 30 years ago. So, you know, just
it was 30 years ago.
It.
And
yeah.
So, there is much more self-help and much more, if you like, sustainable development work. So it's about involving the locals. So it's not about looking for them to run everything the way we do in the West, but running things that are sustainable for them as a culture, as a society, and affordable.
Mm.
At an affordable level. So that has changed. But back then, yes, there was huge waste. And the sheer notion of what it cost to bring expats over to do jobs that could be done by locals was such a shocking waste.
I know, that struck me as I was reading it, and the deeper I got into the book, I was going, what a waste of money. You know, and the whole level that the Irish people who were over there working in Sudan, and not just Sudan, but I'm sure other countries as well in Africa, were being paid a living wage higher than the wage that a local Sudanese would have got. Also, they were provided with an apartment. And then I know there was a reference as well about one of the apartment dwellers who wasn't the neatest, let's call it like that. They were wondering, you know, was this the day that the cleaner came to the apartment? I'm thinking, oh my goodness, here we go. You know, there's government estate aid money, you know, that has been raised by people like me and like you who donate, and then it's being sent off to put people over, if you like, on a world experience. And then where they go and they get an apartment and they get a car and they get a cleaner. So a lot of this for me was kind of, what, did that really happen? And then I had to keep thinking, right, that was 30 years ago.
Well, yes, and I can't claim to know the NGO industry. I mean, there is still, as we know, because it's always coming to light, there is waste in charities. There is things, excess things. I think at the end of the day, I went as a volunteer. I didn't expect to lead a comfortable life. I'm not saying they should put me at risk. That was the other side.
Yes.
On the one hand, I was being offered, you know, I was given an apartment and a comfortable, you know, shelter and food and everything else was provided. And you'd expect the basics to be provided, but it was a bit more than that. But on the other hand, they put me, you know, at serious risk. I mean, foreign exchange dealings was punishable by prison, and nobody wants to end up in a Sudanese prison.
Mm.
And $10,000.
Huge amount of money. Huge amount of money.
And
I could feel your fear through Martha, you know, you as the writer. And another lovely thing that you do in the book very beautifully is that you describe how gorgeous the country is. So Crocodile Island, Tooty Island, and the pyramids. The experience of Ramadan, where people were driving cars like dodgems because they literally hadn't eaten from morning until nightfall. You describe all of that really well. So this is your first book.
It is.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I started writing just about, I suppose, properly about 5 or 6 years ago. And I've written, you know, very short stories and things. And I've been, you know, then I got stuck into this because the Sudanese experience kind of almost demanded to be written about.
Mm. And was it life-changing? Was it life-changing?
Yes.
Sounded it, yeah.
I would, absolutely. I think also, when you go somewhere where nobody knows you, you can find out who you are in some respects. And you have to dig deep. In situations like that, you have to dig deep to rely on yourself and to trust your gut. You don't have anybody to go to conveyor with, you know.
Mm.
So it is life-changing. I think I came home a stronger person, would be how I would see it.
And in the book, after the year, and Martha does grow and develop hugely through the year that she spent in South Sudan, she decides she's going to go on to Kenya.
It's not South Sudan, it was Sudan.
Oh, just Sudan, okay.
It's North Sudan. It's technically, you could call it North Sudan. South Sudan is now a separate country. Back then it was all Sudan.
All
so
right.
There have been various peace agreements, and, you know, the war was in the South, and then eventually it's now become South Sudan. But
Martha in the book went to Khartoum, did she?
Yes, which is in North Sudan.
Okay.
But it's known as Sudan, sorry.
All right. Well, you see, I'm really glad you're explaining all this to me, because this helps. I love a book, by the way, where I learn something. So I learned loads about the place of the book, of the beauty of the country, and the way people live there as well, and the food they eat. I mean, all of that was very interesting for me. But in the book, Vanessa... Did you follow Martha's footsteps? Did you go to Kenya after Sudan?
Oh, I did, yeah. Yeah, I did go to Kenya.
And was that straight away, or did you come home and then unsettle?
Oh, no.
No, straight away.
No, funny, I to be honest with you, Karen, I didn't feel in the frame of mind ready to come back to Ireland. I felt it would have been too ginormous a leap.
Right.
And kind of Kenya sort of felt like a stepping stone. I don't know how to describe that. So I remember when I got to Kenya, I worked as a management consultant with Pricewaterhouse in Kenya, and one of the partners I was working for, I was just talking about the lack of shops in Sudan, and then coming to Nairobi and kind of enjoying being able to buy so many things, and particularly in the market, the fresh fruit and vegetables. And he had just come back from America, and he said he was totally overwhelmed by the 14 different types of oven chips or chips are available in one shop in he was in America, and he said, why would we need those?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it was that leap. I think I felt really, it was to come back from Sudan to be what I would have seen then as the excess we have in Ireland, you know. And so it sat more comfortably with me too.
So you had to decompress, if you like, for a year.
Yes, yeah. So I went on for 4 months to Kenya.
Oh, lovely. Now, I have another question for you. It's your first book, and I know how difficult it is, from speaking to other writers, how difficult it is to write your first novel, because it's in your head for years and years and then you get it out. But there are more difficulties after that. It's the whole thing of trying to find, first of all, trying to find a publisher, and you did, and well done. But after you find a publisher, it's where can you buy the book? So if our listeners want to go out and buy a copy of Deniable Memories, where can they get it?
Well... Well, you know, writing the book's the easy bit in so far as you can enjoy writing the book. The next bit then when you got to try marketing it, and I'm published with Vulpine Press, who are based in Aberdeen. And what happened is I launched during the pandemic, the height of it. And the thing is then you got to try and sell it. And so there was a lot of promo work done around the launch date of the 12th of June. And then what happened is the printers were way behind because of COVID. And so everywhere you clicked to buy it on Amazon or on Waterstones would show up without stock. So in other words, there was an awful lot of publicity and lo and behold, it's out of stock. Now those stocking issues are now solved. And your local bookshop, I am a huge supporter of local bookshops. Unfortunately, it's very hard to get listed with some of them.
So where are you listed? Let's give them a plug. So if your book is available...
Yes, absolutely. Please do. So Bridge Street Books in Wicklow and Raven Books in Blackrock have been the two bookshops who have supported me.
Okay, well, just repeat those for our listeners. So rather than buying it online...
If they want to buy it online, it is available online. But I love supporting...
Bookshops, me too, yeah.
And the two who have been very supportive are Raven Books in Blackrock and Bridge Street Books in Wicklow.
Well done, both those bookshops, for supporting you. I hope you do really well, Vanessa. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Karen.
Not at all.
You've been very good.
My pleasure. And I believe, we're almost out of time, but I believe there is a second book possibly coming as Martha's Adventures Part 2. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, no, so that's gone, that'll be the editing process. I've started the editing process, I've done loads of edits on it, but it's gone to the publishing editor And she'll start working on that probably around September.
Brilliant. So we'll look forward to that in the future. So we've just heard from Vanessa Pierce. She was talking about her debut novel, Deniable Memories. And I'm Karen Meenan, reviewing books from local writers. Thanks for listening.